Fate Rother dipped his head with the required courtesy. He stared at the Lady Fenring. She was golden-haired and willowy, her perfection of figure clothed in a flowing gown of écru, simple fitness of form without ornament. Grey-green eyes stared back at him. She had that Bene Gesserit, serene repose about her that the young man found subtly disturbing.
Said
the Count. He studied Fade Rather.
The precise young man, my dear,
the Count glanced at the Baron.
My dear Baron, you say you've spoken of us to this precise young man. What did you say?
I told my nephew of the great esteem our Emperor holds for you, Count Fenring, the Baron said, and he thought, mark him well, Fade. A killer with the manners of a rabbit. This is the most dangerous kind.
Well, of course, said the Count,
and he smiled at his lady. Fade Rother found the man's actions and words almost insulting. They stopped just short of something overt that would require notice. The young man focused his attention on the Count, a small man, weak-looking. The face was weaselish with overlarge dark eyes. There was grey at the temples, and his movements. He moved a hand or turned his head one way, then he spoke another way. It was difficult to follow.
You come upon such preciseness so rarely, the Count said, addressing the Baron's shoulder. I congratulate you on the perfection of your air. In the light of the elder, one might say.
You are too kind, the Baron said.
He bowed, but Fade Rother noted that his uncle's eyes did not agree with the courtesy.
When you're ironic, that suggests you're thinking deep thoughts, the Count said.
There he goes again, Fade Rother thought. It sounds like he's being insulting, but there's nothing you can call out for satisfaction. Listening to the man gave Fade Rother the feeling his head was being pushed through mush. Fade Rother turned his attention back to the Lady Fenring.
We're taking up too much of this young man's time, she said. I understand he is to appear in the arena today.
By the houris of the Imperial Harem, she's a lovely one, Fade Rother thought.
He said, I shall make a kill for you this day, my lady. I shall make the dedication in the arena with your permission.
She returned his stare serenely, but her voice carried whiplash as she said,
You do not have my permission.
Fade, the Baron said, and he thought, That imp! Does he want this deadly Count to call him out?
But the Count only smiled and said,
You really must be getting ready for the arena, Fade, the Baron said. You must be rested, not take any foolish risks.
Fade Rother bowed, his face dark with resentment.
I'm sure everything will be as you wish, Uncle,
he nodded to Count Fenring.
Sir, to the lady. My lady.
And he turned, strode out of the hall, barely glancing at the knot of families minor near the double doors.
He's so young, the Baron sighed. Indeed,
the Count said. And the Lady Fenring thought, Can that be the young man the Reverend Mother meant? Is that a bloodline we must preserve?
We've more than an hour before going to the arena, the Baron said. Perhaps we could have our little talk now, Count Fenring.
He tipped his gross head to the right.
There's a considerable amount of progress to be discussed.
And the Baron thought, Let us see now how the Emperor's errand boy gets across whatever message he carries, without ever being so crass as to speak it right out. The Count spoke to his lady.
You will excuse us, my dear. Each day, sometime each hour, brings change, she said.
And she smiled sweetly at the Baron before turning away. Her long skirts swished, and she walked with a straight-backed, regal stride toward the double doors at the end of the hall. The Baron noted how all conversation among the houses minor there stopped at her approach, how the eyes followed her.
Bene Gesserit, the Baron thought. The universe will be better rid of them all. There's a cone of silence between two of the pillars over here on our left, the Baron said. We can talk there without fear of being overheard.
He led the way with his waddling gait into the sound-deadening field, feeling the noises of the keep become dull and distant. The Count moved up beside the Baron, and they turned, facing the wall so their lips could not be read.
We're not satisfied with the way you ordered the Sardaukar off Arrakis.
Straight talk, the Baron thought.
The Sardaukar could not stay longer without risking that others would find out how the Emperor helped me.
But your nephew, Raban, does not appear to be pressing strongly enough toward a solution of the Fremen problem.
What does the Emperor wish? There cannot be more than a handful of Fremen left on Arrakis. The southern desert is uninhabitable. The northern desert is swept regularly by our patrols.
Who says the southern desert is uninhabitable?
Your own planetologist said it, my dear Count.
But Dr. Kynes is dead.
Ah, yes. Unfortunate, that.
We've word from an overflight across the southern reaches. There's evidence of plant life.
Has the Guild then agreed to a watch from space?
You know better than that, Baron. The Emperor cannot legally post a watch on Arrakis.
And I cannot afford it. Who made this overflight?
A smuggler.
Someone has lied to you, Count. Smugglers cannot navigate the southern reaches any better than can Raban's men. Storm, sand, static, and all that, you know. Navigation markers are knocked out faster than they can be installed.
We'll discuss various types of static, another time.
Ah, the Baron thought.
Have you found some mistake in my accounting, then?
When you imagine mistakes, there can be no self-defense.
He's deliberately trying to arouse my anger, the Baron thought. He took two deep breaths to calm himself.
He could smell his own sweat, and the harness of the suspensors beneath his robe felt suddenly itchy and galling.
The Emperor cannot be unhappy about the death of the concubine and the boy. They fled into the desert. There was a storm.
Yes. There were so many convenient accidents.
I do not like your tone, Count.
Anger is one thing, violence another. Let me caution you. Should an unfortunate accident occur to me here, the great houses all would learn what you did on Arrakis. They've long suspected how you do business.
The only recent business I can recall was the transportation of several legions of Sardaukar to Arrakis.
You think you could hold that over the Emperor's head?
I wouldn't think of it.
Sardaukar commanders could be found who'd confess they acted without orders because they, wanted a battle with your Fremen scum.
Many might doubt such a confession.
The threat staggered the Baron.
Are Sardaukar truly that disciplined? He wondered.
The Emperor does wish to audit your books.
Any time.
You have no objections?
None. My Chom Company directorship will bear the closest scrutiny.
And he thought, let him bring a false accusation against me and have it exposed. I shall stand there, Promethean, saying, behold me, I am wronged. Then let him bring any other accusation against me, even a true one. The great houses will not believe a second attack from an accuser once proved wrong.
No doubt your books will bear the closest scrutiny.
Why is the Emperor so interested in exterminating the Fremen?
You wish the subject to be changed, eh? It is the Sardaukar who wish it, not the Emperor. They needed practice in killing, and they hate to see a task left undone.
Does he think to frighten me by reminding me that he is supported by bloodthirsty killers? The Baron wondered.
A certain amount of killing has always been an arm of business. But a line has to be drawn somewhere. Someone must be left to work the spice.
Ha! You think you can harness the Fremen?
There never were enough of them for that. But the killing has made the rest of my population uneasy. It's reaching the point where I'm considering another solution to the Arrakeen problem, my dear Fenring. And I must confess the Emperor deserves credit for the inspiration.
Ah?
You see, Count, I have the Emperor's prison planet, Seleucus Secundus, to inspire me.
The Count stared at him with glittering intensity.
What possible connection is there between Arrakis and Seleucus Secundus?
The Baron felt the alertness in Fenring's eyes.
No connection yet.
Yet?
You must admit, it'd be a way to develop a substantial workforce on Arrakis, use the place as a prison planet.
You anticipate an increase in prisoners?
There has been unrest. I've had to squeeze rather severely, Fenring. After all, you know the price I paid that damnable guild to transport our mutual force to Arrakis? That money has to come from somewhere.
I suggest you not use Arrakis as a prison planet without the Emperor's permission, Baron.
Of course not.
Another matter. We learned that Duke Leto's mentat, Thufir Hawat, is not dead, but in your employ.
I could not bring myself to waste him.
You lied to our Sardaukar commander when you said Hawat was dead.
Only a white lie, my dear Count. I hadn't the stomach for a long argument with the man.
Was Hawat the real traitor?
Oh, goodness, no. It was the false doctor.
The Baron wiped at perspiration on his neck.
You must understand, Fenring, I was without a mentat. You know that. I've never been without a mentat. It was most unsettling.
How could you get Hawat to shift allegiance?
His duke was dead.
The Baron forced a smile.
There's nothing to fear from Hawat, my dear Count. The mentat's flesh has been impregnated with a latent poison. We administer an antidote in his meals. Without the antidote, the poison is triggered. He'd die in a few days.
Withdraw the antidote.
But he's useful.
And he knows too many things no living man should know.
You said the Emperor doesn't fear exposure.
Don't play games with me, Baron.
When I see such an order above the Imperial Seal, I'll obey it. But I'll not submit to your whim.
You think it whim?
What else can it be? The Emperor has obligations to me too, Fenring. I rid him of the troublesome Duke.
With the help of a few Sardaukar.
Where else would the Emperor have found a house to provide the disguising uniforms to hide his hand in this matter?
He has asked himself the same question, Baron, but with a slightly different emphasis.
The Baron studied Fenring, noting the stiffness of jaw muscles, the careful control.
Ah, now, I hope the Emperor doesn't believe he can move against me in total secrecy.
He hopes it won't, become necessary.
The Emperor cannot believe I threaten him.
The Baron permitted anger and grief to edge his voice, thinking, let him wrong me in that. I could place myself on the throne while still beating my breast over how I'd been wronged.
The Emperor believes what his senses tell him.
Dare the Emperor charge me with treason before a full Landsraad council?
And the Baron held his breath with the hope of it.
The Emperor need dare nothing.
The Baron whirled away in his suspensers to hide his expression. It could happen in my lifetime, he thought. Emperor, let him wrong me. Then, the bribes and coercion, the rallying of the great houses, they flock to my banner like peasants running for shelter. The thing they'd fear above all else is the Emperor's Sardaukar loosed upon them one house at a time.
It's the Emperor's sincere hope, he'll never have to charge you with treason.
The Baron found it difficult to keep irony out of his voice and permit only the expression of hurt. But he managed.
I've been a most loyal subject. These words hurt me beyond my capacity to express. It's time to go to the arena.
Indeed.
They moved out of the cone of silence and, side by side, walked toward the clumps of houses minor at the end of the hall. A bell began a slow tolling somewhere in the keep, 20-minute warning for the arena gathering.
"The houses minor wait for you to lead them," the Count said, nodding toward the people they approached.
Double meaning. Double meaning, the Baron thought. He looked up at the new talismans flanking the exit to his hall, the mounted bull's head, and the oil painting of the old Duke Atreides, the late Duke Leto's father. They filled the Baron with an odd sense of foreboding, and he wondered what thoughts these talismans had inspired in the Duke Leto as they hung in the halls of Caladan and then on Arrakis, the Bravura father, and the head of the bull that had killed him.
"Mankind has only one science," the Count said as they picked up their parade of followers and emerged from the hall into the waiting room, a narrow space with high windows and floor of patterned white and purple tile.
"And what science is that?" the Baron asked.
"It's the science of discontent," the Count said.
The houses minor behind them, sheep-faced and responsive, laughed with just the right tone of appreciation, but the sound carried a note of discord as it collided with a sudden blast of motors that came to them when pages threw open the outer doors, revealing the line of ground cars, their guidon pennants whipping in a breeze. The Baron raised his voice to surmount the sudden noise, said,
"I hope you'll not be discontented with the performance of my nephew today, Count Fenring.
I am filled only with a sense of anticipation, yes," the Count said. "Always in the process verbal, one must consider the office of origin."
The Baron did his sudden stiffening of surprise by stumbling on the first step down from the exit. Process verbal. That was a report of a crime against the Imperium. But the Count chuckled to make it seem a joke, and patted the Baron's arm. All the way to the arena, though, the Baron sat back among the armoured cushions of his car, casting covert glances at the Count beside him, wondering why the Emperor's errand boy had thought it necessary to make that particular kind of joke in front of the house's minor. It was obvious that Fenring seldom did anything he felt to be unnecessary, or used two words where one would do, or held himself to a single meaning in a single phrase. They were seated in the golden box above the triangular arena, horns blaring, the tiers above and around them jammed with a hubbub of people and waving pennants. When the answer came to the Baron,
"My dear Baron," the Count said, leaning close to his ear, "you know, don't you, that the Emperor has not given official sanction to your choice of heir?"
The Baron felt himself to be within a sudden personal cone of silence, produced by his own shock. He stared at Fenring, barely seeing the Count's lady come through the guards beyond to join the party in the golden box.
"That's really why I'm here today," the Count said. "The Emperor wishes me to report on whether you've chosen a worthy successor.
There's nothing like the arena to expose the true person from beneath the mask, eh?"
"The Emperor promised me free choice of heir," the Baron grated.
"We shall see," Fenring said, and turned away to greet his lady.
She sat down, smiling at the Baron, then giving her attention to the sand floor beneath them, where Fade Rautha was emerging in gilles and tights, the black glove and the long knife in his right hand, the white glove and the short knife in his left hand.
"White for poison, black for purity," the Lady Fenring said. "A curious custom, isn't it, my love?"
The Count said. The greeting cheer lifted from the family galleries, and Fade Rautha paused to accept it, looking up and scanning the faces, seeing his cousine and cousins, the demi-brothers, the concubines and out-frain relations. They were so many pink trumpet mouths yammering amidst a flutter of colourful clothing and banners. It came to Fade Rauther then that the packed ranks of faces would look just as avidly at his blood as at that of the slave gladiator. There was not a doubt of the outcome in this fight, of course. Here was only the form of danger without its substance. Fade Rauther held up his knives to the sun, saluted the three corners of the arena in the ancient manner. The short knife in white-gloved hand, white, the sign of poison, went first into its sheath. Then the long blade in the black-gloved hand, the pure blade that now was unpure, his secret weapon to turn this day into a purely personal victory, poison on the black blade. The adjustment of his body shield took only a moment, and he paused to sense the skin tightening at his forehead, assuring him he was properly guarded. This moment carried its own suspense, and Fade Rauther dragged it out with a sure hand of a showman, nodding to his handlers and distractors, checking their equipment with a measuring stare, gyves in place with their prickles sharp and glistening, the barbs and hooks weaving with their blue streamers. Fade Rauther signalled the musicians. The slow march began, sonorous with its ancient pomp, and Fade Rauther led his troop across the arena for obeisance at the foot of his uncle's box. He caught the ceremonial key as it was thrown. The music stopped. Into the abrupt silence he stepped back 2 paces, raised the key, and shouted, "I dedicate this truth to—" And he paused, knowing his uncle would think, "The young fool's going to dedicate to Lady Fenring after all and cause a ruckus." "To my uncle and patron, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen," Fade Rauther shouted. He was delighted to see his uncle sigh. The music resumed at the quick march, and Fade Rauther led his men scampering back across the arena to the prudence door that admitted only those wearing the proper identification band. Fade Rauther prided himself that he never used the prue door, and seldom needed distractors. But it was good to know they were available this day. Special plans sometimes involved special dangers. Again silence settled over the arena. Fade Rauther turned, faced the big red door across from him through which the gladiator would emerge. The special gladiator. The plan Thufir Hawat had devised was admirably simple and direct, Fade Rauther thought. The slave would not be drugged. That was the danger. Instead, a key word had been drummed into the man's unconscious to immobilize his muscles at a critical instant. Fade Rauther rolled the vital word in his mind, mouthing it without sound. Scum. To the audience it would appear that an undrugged slave had been slipped into the arena to kill the Na Baron, and all the carefully arranged evidence would point to the slave master. A low humming arose from the Red Door's servo motors as they were armed for opening. Fade Rauther focused all his awareness on the door. This first moment was the critical one. The appearance of the gladiator as he emerged told the trained eye much it needed to know. All gladiators were supposed to be hyped on Elaka drug to come out kill-ready in fighting stance, but you had to watch how they hefted the knife, which way they turned in defense, whether they were actually aware of the audience in the stands. The way a slave cocked his head could give the most vital clue to counter and feint. The red door slammed open. Out charged a tall, muscular man with shaved head and darkly pitted eyes. His skin was carrot-coloured, as it should be from the Alaka drug, but Fade Rauther knew the colour was paint. The slave wore green leotards and the red belt of a semi-shield, the belt's arrow pointing left, to indicate the slave's left side was shielded. He held his knife sword-fashion, cocked slightly outward in the stance of a trained fighter. Slowly he advanced into the arena, turning his shielded side toward Fade Rauther and the group at the prue door.
"I like not the look of this one," said one of Fade Rauther's barbmen. "Are you sure he's drugged, my lord?"
"He has the colour," Fade Rauther said.
"Yet he stands like a fighter," said another helper.
Fade Rauther advanced 2 steps onto the sand, studied this slave.
"What has he done to his arm?" asked one of the distractors.
Fade Rauther's attention went to a bloody scratch on the man's left forearm, followed the arm down to the hand as it pointed to a design drawn in blood on the left hip of the green leotards, a wet shape there, the formalized outline of a hawk.
Hawk?
Feyd-Rautha looked up into the darkly pitted eyes, saw them glaring at him with uncommon alertness.
It's one of Duke Leto's fighting men we took on Arrakis, Feyd-Rautha thought. No simple gladiator this.
A chill ran through him, and he wondered if Howard had another plan for this arena, a feint within a feint within a feint, and only the slave master prepared to take the blame. Feyd-Rautha's chief handler spoke at his ear.
I like not the look on that one, my lord. Let me set a barb or two in his knife arm to try him.
I'll set my own barbs, Feyd-Rautha said.
He took a pair of the long, hooked shafts from the handler, hefted them, testing the balance. These barbs, too, were supposed to be drugged, but not this time, and the chief handler might die because of that. But it was all part of the plan.
"You'll come out of this a hero," Howard had said. "Killed your gladiator man to man, and in spite of treachery. The slave master will be executed, and your man will step into his spot."
Feyd-Rautha advanced another 5 paces into the arena, playing out the moment, studying the slave. Already, he knew, the experts in the stands above him were aware that something was wrong. The gladiator had the correct skin colour for a drugged man, but he stood his ground and did not tremble. The aficionados would be whispering among themselves now, "See how he stands. He should be agitated, attacking or retreating. See how he conserves his strength, how he waits." He should not wait. Feyd-Rautha felt his own excitement kindle. Let there be treachery in Howard's mind, he thought. I can handle this slave, and it's my long knife that carries the poison this time, not the short one. Even Howard doesn't know that.
Hi, Harkonnen, the slave called. Are you prepared to die?
Deathly stillness gripped the arena. Slaves did not issue the challenge. Now Feyd-Rautha had a clear view of the gladiator's eyes, saw the cold ferocity of despair in them. He marked the way the man stood, loose and ready, muscles prepared for victory. The slave grapevine had carried Howard's message to this one. You'll get a true chance to kill the Nar Baron. That much of the scheme was as they'd planned it, then. A tight smile crossed Feyd-Rautha's mouth. He lifted the barbs, seeing success for his plans in the way the gladiator stood.
Hi! Hi!
The slave challenged, and crept forward 2 steps.
No one in the galleries can mistake it now, Feyd-Rautha thought.
This slave should have been partly crippled by drug-induced terror. Every movement should have betrayed his inner knowledge that there was no hope for him, he could not win. He should have been filled with the stories of the poisons the Nar Baron chose for the blade in his white-gloved hand. The Nar Baron never gave quick death. He delighted in demonstrating rare poisons, could stand in the arena pointing out interesting side effects on a writhing victim. There was fear in the slave, yes, but not terror. Feyd-Rautha lifted the barbs high, nodded in an almost greeting. The gladiator pounced. His feint and defensive counter were as good as any Feyd-Rautha had ever seen. A timed side blow missed by the barest fraction from severing the tendons of the Nar Baron's left leg. Feyd-Rautha danced away, leaving a barbed shaft in the slave's right forearm, the hooks completely buried in flesh where the man could not withdraw them without ripping tendons. A concerted gasp lifted from the galleries. The sound filled Feyd-Rautha with elation. He knew now what his uncle was experiencing, sitting up there with the Fenrings, the observers from the Imperial Court beside him. There could be no interference with this fight. The forms must be observed in front of witnesses, and the Baron would interpret the events in the arena only one way, threat to himself. The slave backed, holding knife in teeth, and lashing the barbed shaft to his arm with the pennant.
I do not feel your needle, he shouted.
Again he crept forward, knife ready, left side presented, his body bent backward to give it the greatest surface of protection from the half-shield. That action, too, didn't escape the galleries. Sharp cries came from the family boxes. Feyd-Rautha's handlers were calling out to ask if he needed them. He waved them back to the Prudor.
I'll give them a show such as they've never had before,
Feyd-Rautha thought.
No tame killing where they can sit back and admire the style. This'll be something to take them by the guts and twist them.
When I'm barren, they'll remember this day, and won't be a one of them can escape fear of me because of this day. Phaedrotha gave ground slowly before the gladiator's crab-like advance. Arena sand grated underfoot. He heard the slaves panting, smelled his own sweat and a faint odor of blood on the air. Steadily, the Narbaran moved backward, turning to the right, his second barb ready. The slave danced sideways. Phaedrotha appeared to stumble, heard the screams from the galleries. Again, the slave pounced.
Gods, what a fighting man, Phaedrotha thought, as he leaped aside.
Only youth's quickness saved him, but he left the second barb buried in the deltoid muscle of the slave's right arm. Shrill cheers rained from the galleries.
They cheer me now, Phaedrotha thought.
He heard the wildness in the voices just as Howard had said he would. They'd never cheered a family fighter that way before. And he thought, with an edge of grimness, on a thing Howard had told him.
It's easier to be terrified by an enemy you admire.
Swiftly, Phaedrotha retreated to the centre of the arena where all could see clearly. He drew his long blade, crouched, and waited for the advancing slave. The man took only the time to lash the second barb tight to his arm, then sped in pursuit.
Let the family see me do this thing, Phaedrotha thought. I am their enemy. Let them think of me as they see me now.
He drew his short blade.
I do not fear you, Harkonnen swine, the gladiator said. Your tortures cannot hurt a dead man. I can be dead on my own blade before a handler lays finger to my flesh, and I'll have you dead beside me.
Phaedrotha grinned, offering now the long blade, the one with the poison.
"Try this on,"
he said, and fainted, with the short blade in his other hand. The slave shifted knife hands, turned inside both parry and feint to grapple the Narbaran's short blade, the one in the white-gloved hand that tradition said should carry the poison.
"You will die, Harkonnen," the gladiator gasped.
They struggled sideways across the sand. Where Phaedrotha's shield met the slave's half-shield, a blue glow marked the contact, the air around them filled with ozone from the field.
"Die on your own poison!"
the slave grated. He began forcing the white-gloved hand inward, turning the blade he thought carried the poison.
"Let them see this," Phaedrotha thought.
He brought down the long blade, felt it clang uselessly against the barbed shaft lashed to the slave's arm. Phaedrotha felt a moment of desperation. He had not thought the barbed shafts would be an advantage for the slave, but they gave the man another shield. And the strength of this gladiator, the short blade was being forced inward inexorably, and Phaedrotha focused on the fact that a man could also die on an unpoisoned blade.
"Scum!" Phaedrotha gasped.
At the key word, the gladiator's muscles obeyed with a momentary slackness. It was enough for Phaedrotha. He opened a space between them sufficient for the long blade. Its poisoned tip flicked out, drew a red line down the slave's chest. There was instant agony in the poison. The man disengaged himself, staggered backward.
"Now let my dear family watch," Phaedrotha thought. "Let them think on this slave who tried to turn the knife he thought poisoned and use it against me. Let them wonder how a gladiator could come into this arena ready for such an attempt, and let them always be aware they cannot know for sure which of my hands carries the poison."
Phaedrotha stood in silence, watching the slow motions of the slave. The man moved within a hesitation awareness. There was an orthographic thing on his face now for every watcher to recognize. The death was written there. The slave knew it had been done to him, and he knew how it had been done. The wrong blade had carried the poison.
"You!"
the man moaned. Phaedrotha drew back to give death its space. The paralyzing drug in the poison had yet to take full effect, but the man's slowness told of its advance. The slave staggered forward as though drawn by a string, one dragging step at a time. Each step was the only step in his universe. He still clutched his knife, but its point wavered.
"One day, one of us will get you,"
he gasped. A sad little mue contorted his mouth. He sat, sagged, then stiffened and rolled away from Phaedrotha, face down.
Phaedratha advanced in the silent arena, put a toe under the gladiator and rolled him onto his back to give the galleries a clear view of the face when the poison began its twisting, wrenching work on the muscles. But the gladiator came over with his own knife protruding from his breast. In spite of frustration, there was for Phaedratha a measure of admiration for the effort this slave had managed in overcoming the paralysis to do this thing to himself. With the admiration came the realization that here was truly a thing to fear. That which makes a man superhuman is terrifying. As he focused on this thought, Phaedratha became conscious of the eruption of noise from the stands and galleries around him. They were cheering with utter abandon. Phaedratha turned, looking up at them. All were cheering except the Baron, who sat with hand to chin in deep contemplation, and the Count and his lady, both of whom were staring down at him, their faces masked by smiles. Count Fenring turned to his lady, said,
"'Resourceful young man, my dear. His synaptic responses are very swift,' she said.
The Baron looked at her, at the Count, returned his attention to the arena, thinking, "'If someone could get that close to one of mine!' Rage began to replace his fear. "'I'll have the slave master dead over a slow fire this night!' And if this Count and his lady had a hand in it... The conversation in the Baron's box was remote movement to Phaedratha. The voices drowned in the foot-stamping chant that came now from all around. Head! 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 The Baron scowled, seeing the way Phaedratha turned to him. Languidly controlling his rage with difficulty, the Baron waved his hand toward the young man standing in the arena beside the sprawled body of the slave. "'Give the boy a head. He earned it by exposing the slave master.' Phaedratha saw the signal of agreement, thought, "'They think they honour me. Let them see what I think.' He saw his handlers approaching with a saw knife to do the honours, waved them back, repeated the gesture as they hesitated. "'They think they honour me with just a head,' he thought. He bent and crossed the gladiator's hands around the protruding knife handle, then removed the knife and placed it in the limp hands. It was done in an instant, and he straightened, beckoned his handlers. "'Bury this slave intact with his knife in his hands,' he said. "'The man earned it.' In the golden box, Count Fenring leaned close to the Baron, said, "'A grand gesture, that. True bravura.' Your nephew has style as well as courage.
He insults the crowd by refusing the head, the Baron muttered.
Not at all, Lady Fenring said. She turned, looking up at the tears around them. And the Baron noted the line of her neck, a truly lovely flowing of muscles, like a young boy's. They like what your nephew did, she said.
As the import of Phaedratha's gesture penetrated to the most distant seats, as the people saw the handlers carrying off the dead gladiator intact, the Baron watched them and realized she had interpreted the reaction correctly. The people were going wild, beating on each other, screaming and stamping. The Baron spoke wearily.
"'I shall have to order a fete. You cannot send people home like this, their energies unspent. They must see that I share their elation.'
He gave a hand signal to his guard, and a servant above them dipped the Harkonnen orange pennant over the box once, twice, three times. Signal for a fete. Phaedratha crossed the arena to stand beneath the golden box, his weapons sheathed, arms hanging at his sides. Above the undiminished frenzy of the crowd he called, "'A fete, uncle!' The noise began to subside as people saw the conversation and waited.
"'In your honour, Phaed!' the Baron called down,
and again he caused the pennant to be dipped in signal. Across the arena the Prue barriers had been dropped, and young men were leaping down into the arena, racing toward Phaedratha.
"'You ordered the Prue shields dropped, Baron?' the Count asked.
"'No one will harm the lad,' the Baron said. "'He's a hero.'
The first of the charging mass reached Phaedratha, lifted him on their shoulders, began parading around the arena.
"'He could walk unarmed and unshielded through the poorest quarters of Harko tonight,' the Baron said. They give him the last of their food and drink just for his company.
The Baron pushed himself from his chair, settled his weight into his suspensers.
You will forgive me, please. There are matters that require my immediate attention. The guard will see you to the keep.
The Count arose, bowed.
Certainly, Baron. We're looking forward to the fete. I've, never seen a Harkonnen fete.
Yes, the Baron said. The fete.
He turned, was enveloped by guards as he stepped into the private exit from the box. A guard captain bowed to Count Fenring.
Your orders, my lord?
We will, wait for the worst, crush to, pass, the Count said.
Yes, my lord.
The man bowed himself back 3 paces. Count Fenring faced his lady, spoke again in their personal humming code tongue.
You saw it, of course.
In the same humming tongue, she answered.
Ah, the lad knew the gladiator wouldn't be drugged. There was a moment of fear, yes, but no surprise.
It was planned. The entire performance.
Without a doubt.
It stinks of Howart.
Indeed.
I demanded earlier that the Baron eliminate Howart.
That was an error, my dear.
I see that now.
The Harkonnens may have a new Baron ere long.
If that's Howart's plan.
That will bear examination, true.
The young one will be more amenable to control.
For us. After tonight.
You don't anticipate difficulty seducing him, my little broodmother?
No, my love. You saw how he looked at me.
Yes, and I can see now why we must have that bloodline.
Indeed. And it's obvious we must have a hold on him. I'll plant deep in his deepest self the necessary Prana Bindu phrases to bend him.
We'll leave as soon as possible. As soon as you're sure.
Oh, by all means. I should not want to bear a child in this terrible place.
The things we do in the name of humanity.
Yours is the easy part.
There are some ancient prejudices I overcome. They're quite primordial, you know.
Oh, my poor dear. You know this is the only way to be sure of saving that bloodline.
I quite understand what we do.
We won't fail.
Guilt starts as a feeling of failure.
There'll be no guilt. Hypnoligation of that Fade Routher's psyche and his child in my womb, then we go.
That uncle. Have you ever seen such distortion?
He's pretty fierce, but the nephew could well grow to be worse.
Thanks to that uncle. You know, when you think what this lad could have been with some other upbringing, with the Atreides code to guide him, for example.
It's sad.
Would that we could have saved both the Atreides youth and this one. From what I heard of that young Paul, a most admirable lad, good union of breeding and training. But we shouldn't waste sorrow over the aristocracy of misfortune.
There's a Bene Gesserit saying.
You have sayings for everything.
Oh, you'll like this one. It goes, do not count a human dead until you've seen his body. And even then, you can make a mistake.
Muad'Dib tells us in A Time of Reflection that his first collisions with Arrakeen necessities were the true beginnings of his education. He learned then how to poll the sand for its weather, learned the language of the wind's needles stinging his skin, learned how the nose can buzz with sand itch, and how to gather his body's precious moisture around him to guard it and preserve it. As his eyes assumed the blue of the Ibad, he learned the Chocopsa way. Stilgar's preface to Muad'Dib the Man by the Princess Irulan.
Stilgar's troop, returning to the Sietch with its 2 strays from the desert, climbed out of the basin in the waning light of the first moon. The robed figures hurried with the smell of home in their nostrils. Dawn's grey line behind them was brightest at the notch in their horizon calendar that marked the middle of autumn, the month of Caprock. Wind-raked dead leaves strewed the cliff base where the Siege children had been gathering them, but the sounds of the troops' passage, except for occasional blunderings by Paul and his mother, could not be distinguished from the natural sounds of the night. Paul wiped sweat-caked dust from his forehead, felt a tug at his arm, heard Chaney's voice hissing,
"Do as I told you. Bring the fold of your hood down over your forehead. Leave only the eyes exposed. You waste moisture."
A whispered command behind them demanded silence.
"The desert hears you."
A bird chirruped from the rocks high above them. The troop stopped, and Paul sensed abrupt tension. There came a faint thumping from the rocks, a sound no louder than mice jumping in the sand. Again the bird chirruped. A stir passed through the troop's ranks, and again the mouse thumping pecked its way across the sand. Once more the bird chirruped. The troop resumed its climb up into a crack in the rocks, but there was a stillness of breath about the Fremen now that filled Paul with caution, and he noted covert glances toward Chaney, the way she seemed to withdraw, pulling in upon herself. There was rock underfoot now, a faint grey swishing of robes around them, and Paul sensed the relaxing of discipline, but still that quiet of the person about Chaney and the others. He followed a shadow shape, up steps, a turn, more steps, into a tunnel, past two moisture-sealed doors and into a globe-lighted narrow passage with yellow rock walls and ceiling. All around him, Paul saw the Fremen throwing back their hoods, removing nose plugs, breathing deeply. Someone sighed. Paul looked for Chaney, found that she had left his side. He was hemmed in by a press of robed bodies. Someone jostled him, said,
"Excuse me, Usul, what a crush! It's always this way."
On his left, the narrow, bearded face of the one called Farouk turned toward Paul. The stained eye-pits and blue darkness of eyes appeared even darker under the yellow globes.
"Throw off your hood, Usul," Farouk said. "You're home."
And he helped Paul, releasing the hood catch, elbowing a space around them. Paul slipped out his nose plugs, swung the mouth baffle aside. The odor of the place assailed him, unwashed bodies, distillate esters of reclaimed wastes, everywhere the sour effluvia of humanity, with, over it all, a turbulence of spice and spice-like harmonics.
"Why are we waiting, Farouk?" Paul asked. "For the Reverend Mother, I think. You heard the message?" "Poor Chaney."
"Poor Chaney?" Paul asked himself. He looked around, wondering where she was, where his mother had got to in all this crush. Farouk took a deep breath.
"This smells of home," he said.
Paul saw that the man was enjoying the stink of this air, that there was no irony in his tone. He heard his mother cough then, and her voice came back to him through the press of the troop.
"How rich the odors of your siege, Stilgar. I see you do much working with the spice. You make paper? Plastics? And isn't that chemical explosives? You know this from what you smell?"
It was another man's voice, and Paul realized she was speaking for his benefit, that she wanted him to make a quick acceptance of this assault on his nostrils. There came a buzz of activity at the head of the troop, and a prolonged indrawn breath that seemed to pass through the Fremen, and Paul heard hushed voices back down the line.
"It's true, then. Liet is dead."
Liet, Paul thought. Then, Chaney, daughter of Liet. The pieces fell together in his mind. Liet was the Fremen name of the planetologist. Paul looked at Farouk, asked,
"Is it the Liet known as Kynes?" "There is only one Liet," Farouk said.
Paul turned, stared at the robed back of a Fremen in front of him.
"Then Liet Kynes is dead," he thought. "It was Harkonnen treachery," someone hissed. "They made it seem an accident, lost in the desert, a thopter crash."
Paul felt a burst of anger, the man who had befriended them, helped save them from the Harkonnen hunters, the man who had sent his Fremen cohorts searching for two strays in the desert, another victim of the Harkonnens.
"Does Ussul hunger yet for revenge?" Farouk asked.
Before Paul could answer, there came a low call, and the troop swept forward into a wider chamber, carrying Paul with them. He found himself in an open space, confronted by Stilgar, and a strange woman wearing a flowing, wrap-around garment of brilliant orange and green. Her arms were bare to the shoulders, and he could see she wore no stillsuit. Her skin was a pale olive. Dark hair swept back from her high forehead, throwing emphasis on sharp cheekbones and aquiline nose between the dense darkness of her eyes. She turned toward him, and Paul saw golden rings threaded with water tallies dangling from her ears.
"This bested my gems?" she demanded.
"Be silent, Hera," Stilgar said. "It was James's doing. He invoked the Tahadi al-Burhan."
"He's not but a boy," she said.
She gave her head a sharp shake from side to side, setting the water tallies to jingling.
"My children made fatherless by another child? Surely, 'twas an accident."
"Ussul, how many years have you?"
Stilgar asked.
15 standard," Paul said.
Stilgar swept his eyes over the troop.
"Is there one among you cares to challenge me?"
Silence. Stilgar looked at the woman.
"Until I've learned his weirding ways, I'd not challenge him."
She returned his stare.
"But
you saw the stranger woman who went with Cheney to the Reverend Mother?" Stilgar asked. "She's an Outfrain Sayadina, mother to this lad. The mother and son are masters of the weirding ways of battle."
"Lisa Nalgaib,"
the woman whispered. Her eyes held awe as she turned them back toward Paul. The legend again, Paul thought.
"Perhaps," Stilgar said. "It hasn't been tested, though."
He returned his attention to Paul.
"Ussul, it's our way that you've now the responsibility for James's woman here and for his two sons. His Yali, his quarters are yours, his coffee service is yours. And this, his woman."
Paul studied the woman, wondering, "Why isn't she mourning her man? Why does she show no hate for me?" Abruptly he saw that the Fremen were staring at him, waiting. Someone whispered,
"There's work to do. Say how you accept her."
Stilgar said,
"Do you accept Hera as woman or servant?"
Hera lifted her arms, turning slowly on one heel.
"I am still young, Ussul. It said I still look as young as when I was with Jeff, before James bested him."
James killed another to win her, Paul thought. Paul said,
"If I accept her as servant, may I yet change my mind at a later time?"
"You'd have a year to change your decision," Stilgar said. "After that, she's a free woman to choose as she wishes, or you could free her to choose for herself at any time. But she's your responsibility, no matter what, for 1 year, and you'll always share some responsibility for the sons of James."
"I accept her as servant," Paul said.
Hera stamped a foot, shook her shoulders with anger.
"But I'm young!"
Stilgar looked at Paul, said,
"Caution's a worthy trait in a man who'd lead."
"But I'm young," Hera repeated.
"Be silent," Stilgar commanded. "If a thing has merit, it'll be. Show Ussul to his quarters and see he has fresh clothing and a place to rest."
"Oh!"
she said. Paul had registered enough of her to have a first approximation. He felt the impatience of the troop, knew many things were being delayed here. He wondered if he dared ask the whereabouts of his mother and Cheney, saw from Stilgar's nervous stance that it would be a mistake. He faced Hera, pitched his voice with tone and tremolo to accent her fear and awe, said,
"Show me my quarters, Hera. We will discuss your youth another time."
She backed away 2 steps, cast a frightened glance at Stilgar.
"He has the weirding voice," she husked.
"Stilgar," Paul said, "Cheney's father put heavy obligation on me. If there's anything..." "It'll be decided in council," Stilgar said.
You can speak then. He nodded in dismissal, turned away with the rest of the troop following him. Paul took Hera's arm, noting how cool her flesh seemed, feeling her tremble. I'll not harm you, Hera, he said. Show me our quarters. And he smoothed his voice with relaxance.
You'll not cast me out when the year's gone, she said. I know for true I'm not as young as once I was.
As long as I live, you'll have a place with me, he said. He released her arm. Come now, where are our quarters? She turned, led the way down the passage, turned right into a wide cross-tunnel lighted by evenly spaced yellow overhead globes. The stone floor was smooth, swept clean of sand. Paul moved up beside her, studied the aquiline profile as they walked.
You do not hate me, Hera? Why should I hate you?
She nodded to a cluster of children who stared at them from the raised ledge of a side passage. Paul glimpsed adult shapes behind the children, partly hidden by filmy hangings.
I bested Jameis. Stilgar said the ceremony was held, and you're a friend of Jameis.
She glanced sidelong at him.
Stilgar said you gave moisture to the dead. Is that truth?
Yes.
It's more than I'll do. Can do.
Don't you mourn him?
In the time of mourning, I'll mourn him.
They passed an arched opening. Paul looked through it at men and women working with stand-mounted machinery in a large, bright chamber. There seemed an extra tempo of urgency to them.
What are they doing in there? Paul asked.
She glanced back as they passed beyond the arch, said,
They hurry to finish the quota in the plastics shop before we flee. We need many dew collectors for the planting.
Flee?
Until the butchers stop hunting us, or are driven from our land.
Paul caught himself in a stumble, sensing an arrested instant of time, remembering a fragment, a visual projection of prescience, but it was displaced like a montage in motion. The bits of his prescient memory were not quite as he remembered them.
The Saduka hunt us, he said.
They'll not find much excepting an empty siege or two, she said, and they'll find their share of death in the sand.
They'll find this place? He asked.
Likely.
Yet we take the time to.
He motioned with his head toward the arch now far behind them.
Make dew collectors?
The planting goes on.
What are dew collectors? He asked.
The glance she turned on him was full of surprise.
Don't they teach you anything in the... wherever it is you come from?
Not about dew collectors.
Hi,
she said, and there was a whole conversation in the one word.
Well, what are they?
Each bush, each weed you see out there in the erg, she said. How do you suppose it lives when we leave it? Each is planted most tenderly in its own little pit. The pits are filled with smooth ovals of chromoplastic. Light turns them white. You can see them glistening in the dawn if you look down from a high place. White reflects. But when Old Father Sun departs, the chromoplastic reverts to transparency in the dark. It cools with extreme rapidity. The surface condenses moisture out of the air. That moisture trickles down to keep our plants alive.
Dew collectors, he muttered, enchanted by the simple beauty of such a scheme.
I'll mourn Jameis in the proper time for it, she said, as though her mind had not left his other question. He was a good man, Jameis, but quick to anger. A good provider, Jameis, and a wonder with the children. He made no separation between Jeff's boy, my firstborn, and his own true son. They were equal in his eyes.
She turned a questing stare on Paul.
Would it be that way with you, Usul?
We don't have that problem.
But if...
Hera...
She recoiled at the harsh edge in his voice. They passed another brightly lighted room visible through an arch on their left.
What's made there? He asked.
They repair the weaving machinery, she said, but it must be dismantled by tonight.
She gestured at a tunnel branching to their left.
Through there and beyond, that's food processing and stillsuit maintenance.
She looked at Paul.
Your suit looks new, but if it needs work, I'm good with suits. I work in the factory in season.
They began coming on knots of people now, and thicker clusterings of openings in the tunnel's sides. A file of men and women passed them, carrying packs that gurgled heavily, the smell of spice strong about them.
"They'll not get our water," Hera said, "or our spice. You can be sure of that."
Paul glanced at the openings in the tunnel walls, seeing the heavy carpets on the raised ledge, glimpses of rooms with bright fabrics on the walls, piled cushions. People in the openings fell silent at their approach, followed Paul with untamed stares.
"The people find it strange you bested Jameis," Hera said. "Likely you'll have some proving to do when we're settled in a new siege."
"I don't like killing," he said.
"Thus Stilgar tells it," she said, but her voice betrayed her disbelief.
A shrill chanting grew louder ahead of them. They came to another side opening, wider than any of the others Paul had seen. He slowed his pace, staring in at a room crowded with children sitting cross-legged on a maroon-carpeted floor. At a chalkboard against the far wall stood a woman in a yellow wraparound, a projecto stylus in one hand. The board was filled with designs. Circles, wedges and curves, snake tracks and squares, flowing arcs split by parallel lines. The woman pointed to the designs one after the other as fast as she could move the stylus, and the children chanted in rhythm with her moving hand. Paul listened, hearing the voices grow dimmer behind as he moved deeper into the siege with Hera.
"Tree," the children chanted. "Tree, grass, dune, wind, mountain, hill, fire, lightning, rock, rocks, dust, sand, heat, shelter, heat, full, winter, cold, empty, erosion, summer, cavern, day, tension, moon, night, caprock, sandtide, slope, planting, binder."
"You conduct classes at a time like this?" Paul asked. Her face went somber and grief edged her voice.
"What Liet taught us, we cannot pause an instant in that. Liet, who is dead, must not be forgotten. It's the Chekobsa way."
She crossed the tunnel to the left, stepped up onto a ledge, parted gauzy orange hangings, and stood aside.
"Your Yali is ready for you, Usu."
Paul hesitated before joining her on the ledge. He felt a sudden reluctance to be alone with this woman. It came to him that he was surrounded by a way of life that could only be understood by postulating an ecology of ideas and values. He felt that this Fremen world was fishing for him, trying to snare him in its ways. And he knew what lay in that snare. The wild jihad, the religious war he felt he should avoid at any cost.
"This is your Yali," Hera said. "Why do you hesitate?"
Paul nodded, joined her on the ledge. He lifted the hangings across from her, feeling metal fibers in the fabric, followed her into a short entranceway and then into a larger room, square, about 6 meters to a side, thick blue carpets on the floor, blue and green fabrics hiding the rock walls, glow globes tuned to yellow overhead, bobbing against draped yellow ceiling fabrics. The effect was that of an ancient tent. Hera stood in front of him, left hand on hip, her eyes studying his face.
"The children are with a friend," she said. "They will present themselves later."
Paul masked his unease beneath a quick scanning of the room. Thin hangings to the right, he saw, partly concealed a larger room with cushions piled around the walls. He felt a soft breeze from an air duct, saw the outlet cunningly hidden in a pattern of hangings directly ahead of him.
"Do you wish me to help you remove your still suit?"
Hera asked.
"No,
thank you."
"Shall I bring food?"
"Yes."
"There is a reclamation chamber off the other room," she gestured, "for your comfort and convenience when you're out of your still suit."
"You said we have to leave this siege," Paul said. "Shouldn't we be packing or something?"
"It will be done in its time," she said. "The butchers have yet to penetrate to our region."
Still she hesitated, staring at him.
"What is it?" he demanded. "You've not the eyes of the Ibad," she said. "It's strange, but not entirely unattractive."
"Get the food," he said. "I'm hungry." She smiled at him. a knowing woman's smile that he found disquieting.
"I am your servant," she said,
and whirled away in one lithe motion, ducking behind a heavy wall hanging that revealed another passage before falling back into place. Feeling angry with himself, Paul brushed through the thin hanging on the right and into the larger room. He stood there a moment, caught by uncertainty, and he wondered where Chaney was. Chaney, who had just lost her father. "We're alike in that," he thought. A wailing cry sounded from the outer corridors, its volume muffled by the intervening hangings. It was repeated, a bit more distant. And again. Paul realized someone was calling the time. He focused on the fact that he had seen no clocks. The faint smell of burning creosote bush came to his nostrils, riding on the omnipresent stink of the siege. Paul saw that he had already suppressed the odorous assault on his senses. And he wondered again about his mother, how the moving montage of the future would incorporate her, and the daughter she bore. Mutable time awareness danced around him. He shook his head sharply, focusing his attention on the evidences that spoke of profound depth and breadth in this Fremen culture that had swallowed him, with its subtle oddities. He had seen a thing about the caverns and this room, a thing that suggested far greater differences than anything he had yet encountered. There was no sign of a poison snooper here, no indication of their use anywhere in the cave warren. Yet he could smell poisons in the siege stench. Strong ones. Common ones. He heard a rustle of hangings, thought it was Hera returning with food, and turned to watch her. Instead, from beneath a displaced pattern of hangings, he saw two young boys, perhaps aged 9 and 10, staring out at him with greedy eyes. Each wore a small kinjal type of kris knife, rested a hand on the hilt. And Paul recalled the stories of the Fremen, that their children fought as ferociously as the adults.
The hands move, the lips move, ideas gush from his words, and his eyes devour. He is an island of selfdom. Description from Emmanuel of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Phosphor tubes in the faraway upper reaches of the cavern cast a dim light onto the thronged interior, hinting at the great size of this rock-enclosed space. Larger, Jessica saw, than even the gathering hall of her Bene Gesserit school. She estimated there were more than 5,000 people gathered out there beneath the ledge where she stood with Stilgar. And more were coming. The air was murmurous with people.
"Your son has been summoned from his rest, Sayadina," Stilgar said. "Do you wish him to share in your decision?"
"Could he change my decision?"
"Certainly. The air with which you speak comes from your own lungs, but—"
"The decision stands," she said.
But she felt misgivings, wondering if she should use Paul as an excuse for backing out of a dangerous course. There was an unborn daughter to think of as well. What endangered the flesh of the mother endangered the flesh of the daughter. Men came with rolled carpets, grunting under the weight of them, stirring up dust as the loads were dropped onto the ledge. Stilgar took her arm, led her back into the acoustical horn that formed the rear limits of the ledge. He indicated a rock bench within the horn.
"The Reverend Mother will sit here, but you may rest yourself until she comes."
"I prefer to stand," Jessica said.
She watched the men unroll the carpets, covering the ledge, looked out at the crowd. There were at least 10,000 people on the rock floor now. And still they came. Out on the desert, she knew, it already was red nightfall, but here in the cavern hall was perpetual twilight, a grey vastness thronged with people come to see her risk her life. A way was opened through the crowd to her right, and she saw Paul approaching, flanked by two small boys. There was a swaggering air of self-importance about the children. They kept hands on knives, scowled at the wall of people on either side.
"The sons of Jamis, who are now the sons of Usul," Stilgar said. "They take their escort duties seriously."
He ventured a smile at Jessica. Jessica recognized the effort to lighten her mood and was grateful for it, but could not take her mind from the danger that confronted her. "I have no choice but to do this," she thought. "We must move swiftly if we're to secure our place among these Fremen." Paul climbed up to the ledge, leaving the children below. He stopped in front of his mother, glanced at Stilgar, back to Jessica. "What is happening? I thought I was being summoned to council." Stilgar raised a hand for silence, gestured to his left where another way had been opened in the throng. Chaney came down the lane opened there, her elfin face set in lines of grief. She had removed her stillsuit and wore a graceful blue wraparound that exposed her thin arms. Near the shoulder on her left arm, a green kerchief had been tied. Green for mourning, Paul thought. It was one of the customs the two sons of Jamis had explained to him by indirection, telling him they wore no green because they accepted him as guardian father.
"Are you the Lisan al-Ghaib?"
they had asked, and Paul had sensed the jihad in their words, shrugging off the question with one of his own, learning then that Kelef, the elder of the two, was 10, and the natural son of Jeff. Orlop, the younger, was 8, the natural son of Jamis. It had been a strange day with these two standing guard over him, because he asked it, keeping away the curious, allowing him the time to nurse his thoughts and prescient memories, to plan a way to prevent the jihad. Now, standing beside his mother on the cavern ledge and looking out at the throng, he wondered if any plan could prevent the wild outpouring of fanatic legions. Chaney, near the ledge, was followed at a distance by 4 women carrying another woman in a litter. Jessica ignored Chaney's approach, focusing all her attention on the woman in the litter, a crone, a wrinkled and shriveled ancient thing in a black gown with hood thrown back to reveal the tight knot of grey hair and the stringy neck. The litter carriers deposited their burden gently on the ledge from below, and Chaney helped the old woman to her feet. "So this is their reverend mother," Jessica thought. The old woman leaned heavily on Chaney as she hobbled toward Jessica, looking like a collection of sticks draped in the black robe. She stopped in front of Jessica, peered upward for a long moment before speaking in a husky whisper.
"So, you're the one?"
The old head nodded once precariously on the thin neck.
"The Shadow the Mapes was right to pity you."
Jessica spoke quickly, scornfully. "I need no one's pity."
"That remains to be seen,"
husked the old woman. She turned with surprising quickness and faced the throng.
"Tell them, Stilgar."
"Must I?" he asked.
"We are the people of Mysr,"
the old woman rasped.
"Since our Sunni ancestors fled from Nilotek al-Ruba, we have known flight and death. The young go on, that our people shall not die."
Stilgar took a deep breath, stepped forward 2 paces. Jessica felt the hush come over the crowded cavern, some 20,000 people now standing silently, almost without movement. It made her feel suddenly small and filled with caution.
"Tonight we must leave this siege that has sheltered us for so long, and go south into the desert,"
Stilgar said. His voice boomed out across the uplifted faces, reverberating with the force given it by the acoustical horn behind the ledge. Still the throng remained silent.
"The Reverend Mother tells me she cannot survive another Hajra," Stilgar said. "We have lived before without a Reverend Mother, but it is not good for people to seek a new home in such straits."
Now the throng stirred, rippling with whispers and currents of disquiet.
"That this may not come to pass," Stilgar said. "Our new Sayadina Jessica of the Weirding has consented to enter the rite at this time. She will attempt to pass within, that we not lose the strength of our Reverend Mother."
Jessica of the Weirding, Jessica thought. She saw Paul staring at her, his eyes filled with questions, but his mouth held silent by all the strangeness around them. "If I die in the attempt, what will become of him?" Jessica asked herself. Again she felt the misgivings fill her mind. Cheney led the old Reverend Mother to a rock bench deep in the acoustical horn, returned to stand beside Stilgar.
"That we may not lose all if Jessica of the Weirding should fail," Stilgar said. "Cheney, daughter of Liet, will be consecrated in the Syadina at this time."
He stepped one pace to the side.